You know, it's funny. If you spend like any time at all looking at investment strategies online, you're constantly bombarded with this glittering, almost cinematic dream of passive income.
Oh, absolutely. The whole sitting on a beach somewhere, sipping something out of a coconut vibe.
Right. And magically your bank account just grows because you own real estate. It sounds incredible. But if you're listening to this right now, you and I both know that you want the actual actionable knowledge, not the marketing fluff.
Yeah, you want the mechanics, not the brochure.
Exactly. You want to understand how these financial vehicles really work without, drowning in a million open browser tabs of conflicting information. And today we're doing a deep dive into an article titled Three: How Rental Income Works Through Fractional Property Ownership.
Which is a fantastic resource, by the way. It really strips down the mechanics of the market right now.
It really does. So our mission today is to explore the reality behind real estate as passive income and decode how these shared ownership structures are completely changing the game for investors.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because we all love the underlying idea of passive income, right? Who wouldn't? The idea that your capital is out there dealing with the daily grind of the physical world, completely independent of your time.
Yeah, but to understand why fractional ownership is gaining so much serious traction right now, we first have to look at why traditional real estate is, well, anything but passive.
Right, it's the big open secret of the real estate world. When we look at traditional direct property ownership, the demands are just
It's like a
relentless.
second job, basically.
It is a second job. You aren't just an investor anymore. Suddenly, you're a property manager, you're a debt collector, and a crisis coordinator all rolled into one.
Which sounds exhausting.
It is. You're managing tenants, you're dealing with structural maintenance issues, chasing down late rent checks, and that's not even mentioning the stress of unexpected vacancies.
Yeah, owning a physical building outright just mutates your financial investment into a massive operational burden. And honestly, it reminds me of adopting a puppy.
Adopting a puppy? Okay, I've got to hear this.
Well, think about it. You get a puppy and you think you're just getting the fun and the cuddles, right? Like that's the rental
Oh,
checks.
I see where this is going.
Yeah. You completely forget that you have to take the puppy outside at 3 a.m. in the freezing rain.
Right.
And that's the emergency maintenance and the tenant complaints.
That is painfully accurate. You hold all the financial risk, plus the absolute certainty of 3 a.m. plumbing disasters.
Exactly. You're holding the bag.
What's fascinating here is that fractional ownership centralizes all of those agonizing responsibilities. It fundamentally shifts real estate from an active chore back to a truly passive investment vehicle.
So instead of you standing in the rain fixing a roof, what actually happens?
You're basically buying shares in income-generating real estate alongside a pool of other participants, and the actual execution, the eviction courts, the property taxes, the maintenance, it's entirely delegated to professional management teams.
Wow. So you just get to step back.
Right. It separates the financial asset from the operational liability, which, if you're looking at your own portfolio, is a highly attractive proposition.
Definitely. You get the exposure without the misery. But, we need to look under the hood here because if you, the listener, aren't the one knocking on a door and collecting a physical rent check, how does the cash actually flow from a brick-and-mortar building into your digital bank account?
Right, the actual plumbing of the transaction. The foundational mechanics are actually pretty straightforward. You have a property that generates gross income primarily through rent.
Okay, that makes sense.
Then a professional asset management team collects that top-line revenue. From that, they deduct all the necessary operational expenditures.
So that would be like what? Routine maintenance, property taxes.
Exactly. Taxes, insurance premiums, and of course, their own management fees. And what remains after those deductions is the net operating income. That's the pool of money that actually gets distributed.
Okay, so it's proportionally distributed based on ownership shares.
Right. If you own 2% of the asset's shares, you receive 2% of that net distribution pie.
It's just a basic revenue minus expenses equation. But let me push back on this a little bit.
Sure.
Because if the math is that straightforward, it almost implies that real estate is just this monolith. Wait, so is a fractional share in a downtown luxury high-rise basically identical to a share in a logistics warehouse as long as they both have tenants?
Oh, absolutely not. Treating real estate as a monolith is a fantastic way to misallocate your capital.
Okay, so they're totally different animals.
Completely. The property type fundamentally alters the DNA of that distribution pie we just talked about. Different property sectors behave entirely differently based on macroeconomic conditions.
Let's break that down then. Let's start with residential properties, like an apartment complex. My assumption is that residential is generally the most stable, right?
Yeah.
Because housing is just a basic human need.
You hit the nail on the head. That inelastic demand is the defining characteristic of residential real estate. People always need a place to live.
Even in a recession, like giving up your home is the absolute last thing you cut from your budget.
Exactly, particularly in major growing urban areas. Because of that, the income stream from a residential asset tends to be highly resilient. You might see minor fluctuations in rental rates, but the underlying demand provides a really sturdy floor.
Okay, but if we pivot and look at commercial property, say an office building or a retail shopping center, the dynamics have to be different.
Very different. The commercial sector is highly sensitive to the broader economic climate.
Because businesses can just break leases or go bankrupt.
Right. Commercial assets typically offer stronger upside potential, meaning the rental yields can be higher, and leases are locked in for longer durations, sometimes 5 to 10 years.
Wow, 10 years is a long time.
It is, but the operational reality is vastly more complex. When a commercial tenant leaves, you aren't just losing rent, you often face massive capital expenditures to retrofit that space for a completely different type of business.
Oh, right. Because a dental office needs a totally different layout than a law firm.
Exactly. So an office building might sit at 50% capacity for 2 years during a downturn. The ceiling for returns is higher, but the floor can drop out much faster than in residential.
That makes total sense. Which brings us to the third category from the article, logistics and mixed use. If I'm buying into a massive distribution warehouse, I'm basically betting on supply chains, right? Not foot traffic.
Correct. Logistics properties are tied intimately to infrastructure growth and regional commerce. Their value surges alongside e-commerce adoption, new highway systems, port expansion.
So they all react differently.
Right. The key takeaway is that consistent, reliable returns depend entirely on having the right kind of property for the current economic cycle and having it managed by professionals who understand those specific tenant relationships.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The irony of this whole fractional ecosystem. These platforms make the physical act of buying real estate incredibly frictionless, you know?
Oh, yeah. A few taps on your phone.
Exactly. You don't need a massive commercial mortgage. You don't need to hire structural engineers. You literally allocate capital from your smartphone in under 5 minutes. But making it that easy actually makes it infinitely more crucial that you do your homework on the fundamentals.
This raises an important question, though. Are you investing in a mathematically sound physical asset, or are you just buying a compelling marketing brochure?
Right, because it's so easy to get seduced by shiny projections.
The removal of friction creates a very dangerous false sense of security. The documentation makes this very clear. Passive income does not mean guaranteed income.
You see a listing screaming projected 15% yield, and your impulse is just to click buy. But the physical building doesn't care that you bought a fractional share on a slick app.
It really doesn't. If the roof caves in, that expense still has to be paid out of the rental income before you see a single dime of your distribution. Your income will fluctuate based on real-world variables.
Vacancies, turnover, local market conditions. And we also need to talk about the liquidity illusion.
Ah, yes. The liquidity illusion.
Because these shares sit in a digital dashboard right next to your stocks, your brain categorizes them as highly liquid. You think, oh, if I need cash tomorrow, I'll just sell my shares in that apartment complex.
Which is a fatal error. Treating real estate like day trading just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Even in a fractional structure, the underlying asset is physical dirt and concrete. It is inherently illiquid.
Even if the platform has a secondary market.
Even then, the volume on those secondary markets is nothing like a public stock exchange. You cannot rely on instant liquidity. It's a long-term investment.
So, inexperienced investors chasing hyped-up short-term projections instead of focusing on stable occupancy. They're basically just gambling.
They are. Shared ownership changes accessibility, but it absolutely does not remove the importance of evaluating property fundamentals carefully. Location quality, tenant demand, management track record, those dictate whether your income stream will exist a decade from now.
So, what does this all mean? Armed with this understanding of the mechanics and the risks, how do smart investors actually utilize this tool? Because deploying smaller, precise allocations seems like it completely rewrites the playbook.
It revolutionizes the playbook, primarily because it solves the most glaring vulnerability of traditional real estate, which is massive concentration risk.
Right, tying all your capital up in one property.
Exactly. In the old model, say you have $100,000, that entire sum gets consumed by one down payment on one specific street. If a major employer leaves that town, your entire portfolio takes a hit.
Your whole financial outcome is held hostage by hyperlocal economics.
Right. You're placing all your chips on a single square. Fractional ownership shatters that limitation. You take that same $100,000 and slice it up.
So I could put like $20,000 into a residential building in a tech hub.
Yes. And another $30,000 into a logistics warehouse near a port. The rest across commercial retail in different regions. You intentionally build a diversified matrix of exposure.
So if there's a localized recession and my retail space loses two tenants, I'm not ruined. The portfolio acts as a shock absorber because I'm still getting that stable residential income.
You've isolated and mitigated the risk, and then when you combine that diversification with reinvesting your returns, it gets incredibly powerful.
Oh, right, because it rewards patience.
Exactly. You take the yield from the warehouse and use it to buy more fractions of the high rise. It compounds over time.
If we look at this on a global scale, the article specifically zeroes in on the Saudi Arabian market as a prime ecosystem for this shift. Which makes sense given the sheer velocity of development there.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the Saudi market is an exceptional case study. You have explosive infrastructure expansion, massive demographic shifts, and a mandate to diversify the economy.
The scale of the real estate is just staggering.
It is, but a rapidly modernizing financial sector needs infrastructure that bridges the gap between massive institutional development and the retail investor.
Right, because an everyday investor can't just walk up and buy a 50-story commercial tower. The traditional model can't interface with modern mega developments.
That's where platforms like Usul Gamma come in. They're mentioned in the source material as operating right in this environment. They provide the technological and legal infrastructure to divide, manage, and distribute shares of these massive assets.
So they act as a translation layer. They take this towering, illiquid asset, wrap it in legal structures, and present it as an accessible fractional opportunity.
Precisely. It allows local investors to participate in the economic expansion of their own country without needing the capital of a sovereign wealth fund. It moves the market away from solitary, massive financial commitments toward flexible, professionally managed portfolios.
That's a complete paradigm shift. We've covered a ton of ground today, so let's quickly recap the journey for you, the listener. We started by dismantling the myth of the passive solo landlord, showing how fractional ownership cures that second job headache by centralizing management.
Separating the financial benefit from the physical labor.
Then we looked at the plumbing, how different property types behave, and why residential stability differs from commercial volatility. And we confronted the reality that removing friction doesn't magically guarantee returns.
You still have to do the fundamental homework.
Exactly. And finally, we explored the strategic power of diversification, avoiding concentration risk, especially in dynamic markets like Saudi Arabia, with platforms like Usul Gamma.
It empowers everyday people to deploy capital like an institutional fund.
It really does. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final unaddressed question to mull over, something to explore on your own.
Okay, let's hear it.
If fractional ownership continues to make buying a piece of a commercial high-rise or an apartment complex as easy as buying a stock, how might this fundamentally change the way everyday people feel about the cities and neighborhoods they live in?
Oh, wow. That's a profound thought.
Think about it. For generations, commercial real estate is just something that happens to a community. But if everyone owns a tiny fraction of their city, the local coffee shop building, the logistics center, does our very definition of community investment change?
Right. Moving from passive residents to active collective owners.
Exactly. Do we evolve into a city of highly engaged micro-owners, deeply invested in the success of our own backyards? It's a fascinating future to imagine. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. We hope unpacking these mechanics gave you the concrete insights you need to intelligently navigate this landscape. Keep learning, keep questioning the fundamentals, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.